Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of Developer Tea. I'm very excited for today's episode. We have a wonderful guest for today's show. His name is Anil Dash. We're going to get to that episode in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to take a moment to invite you to do a couple of things. First, as you're listening to this episode, try to look for things that are valuable to you. And if you find something that's valuable to you, I want you to consider subscribing to this podcast, but also sharing that thing with another person. It's likely that if you found it valuable, then someone else might as well. Secondly, I want to remind you that you can always reach out and talk directly to me. You can email me directly, developertea@gmail.com. And I'm also on Twitter at @developertea. My personal Twitter account is @jcottrell. As I mentioned already, today's guest is Anil Dash. As you'll hear from Anil, this is not his first rodeo. He's been doing things on the internet for a long time. Most recently, he is well known for his role as the founder of Glitch and as the host of the podcast Function. Let's get straight into the interview with Anil Dash. Anil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's kind of an honor. I feel like I've seen your work for a long time, and I think the world is a better place because of what you do. But for those who, for whatever reason, they haven't encountered what you do, the things that you are a part of, can you kind of give a basic background to the work that you're doing in tech?
Sure. I'm a guy that makes stuff on the web. And so the first thing I became known for is I started blogging about 20 years ago, writing about tech and software and pop culture and whatever else. And back then you didn't have to be, you didn't have to pick a lane. You could sort of try stuff. And then along the way, I got to work at a number of startups in the early days of social media. I helped build a tool called Movable Type that was sort of one of the first big blogging tools. And they used, people use that to build Huffington Post and Gawker and other things like that. And then more recently, a lot of my work has been around trying to enable collaboration, creativity, coding together. So I'm on the board of Stack Overflow, and Stack Overflow actually spun out of a company called Fog Creek that had also built Trello, amongst other products. And about 3 years ago, I took over the company, and we launched sort of the latest in that series of products called Glitch. And it has become a very substantial, very interesting community of people creating web stuff together. And it's both a development platform where you can code right in your browser and instantly ship an app, to the entire web. And also a really great creative community where you can sort of see other people's work and remix it and collaborate together. And it's been a pretty, knock on wood, a pretty nice success out of the gate. So we've had just lots and lots of devs come in and feel like, oh, this brings back that creative feeling around coding. And so we ended up actually renaming the company to Glitch and focusing all in on it. And since we decided to do that about a year and a half ago, it's really taken off, and people have now built millions of apps on Glitch. And that's my day-to-day, is running the company and getting to work with the community and the team.
Fantastic. I'm going to ask you a intentionally broad and difficult question about Glitch now.
Sure.
Who is Glitch made for, and who is it made not for? Who is it not made for, I guess, is a better way to, I can use English properly today. Who is it not made for?
Oh, that's a great question. So, the first thing I thought about is every time I'd seen a developer tool in the past, it had always been this, I felt like they had pictured a guy sitting at a desk with a black terminal screen and green text on it. And that was the sort of the ethos and the aesthetic and the mindset of this thing. And it was, you were going to prove your command line bona fides, and this is how you became a developer. And we actually have a great cohort of people that work that way and are using those kinds of tools like Glitch. But it wasn't that we put them first. We thought, we know how to check that box for those kinds of developers. But for people, interestingly, on other, like the sort of opposite ends of the bell curve from that, that's the middle of the curve of developers. On one end are real experts, people who love making stuff on the web, but have had, and they might be, the people that create the frameworks we use or create the tools that we use. And I think they've lost some of the joy and the fun of just making stuff and sharing it because it's become very complicated. You know, you can't just ship stuff and all of a sudden you're negotiating your deployment environment and all this other stuff that's just in the way. And so those very, very experienced coders, I think, have lost the fun or the soul of what connected them to creating. Mm-hmm. And at the other end are beginners. And this can be, you know, a kid who's learning to write their first line of HTML. It can be an experienced developer who's trying out an API that they haven't used before, where they're sort of back to square one. Or somebody that doesn't think of themselves as a coder at all, but maybe they do, you know, they edit formulas in a spreadsheet at work or something like that. But all those people share in common, they've got some technical skill, but they're a little bit out of their comfort zone, a little bit out of their norm. And for them, interestingly, they have the same needs that that expert coder has when they just want to get an idea out of their head, which is, I don't want to worry about the overhead and the complexity. I don't want to be distracted by getting something, just the basics running. I want to be able to express this idea. I want to capture this little moment of inspiration that I had before it evaporates, because it's so fragile. And I see it the same way as, like, you know I have a lot of friends who are musicians, and they'll always have, you know, their guitar tuned and ready and sort of sitting next to them, so that if they got a song stuck in their head, they can just capture it. I think the same thing applies for making stuff on the web, where sometimes you just had this fun idea you want to get out there, and on Glitch it's as easy as finding something close to what you do, remix it and change it, tweak it to be exactly what you need for that idea that's in your head. We're making it for everybody that's ever had a moment where they thought, you know what would be cool to make? You know what the world should see? This one little idea that I have.
Yeah, that's super cool. So there's a lot to be said for lowering the barrier to entry, both for people who are you know, well into the industry, mm-hmm. have a job and are doing fine, but also perhaps more importantly for people who are not in the industry,
who
want to try something for the first time, but they don't want to learn 16 hours worth of Kubernetes material.
Right.
That's not what they're looking for.
Yeah. And even me, sense. You know, like I can provision a server on AWS. Like I can set up a deploy script, but my gosh, I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like I've been at work all day. I just want to make something. And back in the day, I'm old enough. I used to be able to go on GeoCities or LiveJournal or, you know, MySpace, whatever the sites were at the time, and just sort of like shove something onto the internet and it would kind of work. And then it got hard, you know, and so it got so difficult that I couldn't just, you know, try something. I couldn't just experiment. And so having that feel where it's as, you know, like I said, as sort of joyful as just like tapping out a song on a piano or something. It's a nice feeling.
Yeah, I think so what you've said is this really cool idea of a quick idea, get it out on paper, you know. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people may have a misconception about Glitch based on our conversation so far, that it's only made for like these prototyping ideas.
Right.
But there's actually these, like the ability to do a production level thing.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we run Glitch.com, Glitch itself on Glitch. It's a Glitch app that we edit, you know, and we do, and that's obviously, you know, it's mission critical for us. It's a very important app, but you know, there are lots of companies where, you know, you're not going to run your air traffic control system on it. That's fine. You're not going to run a stock exchange on it. But short of that, a lot of times people are just like, I want to, you know, we have some old proprietary app at our company, and we would like to have it, you know, drop something into Slack so we have a reporting system. And I just want to set it up, but I'm not the person at the office who has permission to launch a production app and do all that kind of stuff. And I don't want to ask the IT guys to do it for me in the third quarter of next year. And so maybe I can just put something together. And I think that, you know, that's the work case, but I think that's true at home or somebody who's like, I just want to, you know, put together a website to organize everybody in the neighborhood that wants to clean up the park, the playground, but I don't want to have to do a Facebook group for it. And so there's a lot of just sort of different ways of capturing that impulse, but they're real apps and they really run and they're full stack and they are, you can use any framework, any toolkit, any API. I do think a lot of times we start with that in the coding world of like, here are the technical bona fides, mm-hmm. and not so much the creative impulse, which is, that's the thing I care about the most, is you will actually figure out any tech you need to, or any, you know, you will learn anything you need to learn if there is an idea that just animates you so much that you need to create it in the world. And so many of us learned that way to begin with, or at least started that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to just sort of enable that, because the, you know, the expert coders are very well tended to. There are tons of resources, tons of capabilities. But the people who are like, I just need to get this idea out there. And then maybe they've got some experience coding, or maybe you don't, but will handle all that other complexity, no matter how far you want to go. If you want to run a large scale production site like people are, that's great. That's all in there. But you don't have to think about that when you start.
Right. Yeah. I think there's an interesting discussion here that kind of emerges when you start thinking about, you know, that seam between, and back when I was in agency work, especially, I saw the seam pronounced even more, but it's between the kind of creative people and the technically adept people, right?
Yeah.
The designer and developer prototype kind of people, where the designer is kind of quarantined to this area where, you know, they might be able to make a motion prototypes. They may even be able to work with HTML and JavaScript.
Right.
But there's no way that that stuff is going to make it over that seam. Mm-hmm. It's not going to get into the quote real app.
Yeah.
Right.
And it got harder too, because we introduced the frameworks and the toolkits and the build scripts that you couldn't just tweak it yourself. Now you had
to,
you had to have this knowledge.
Yeah, we kind of lock people into React now. And if you don't have this big, and it creates, again, the barrier to entry is like growing, right?
Yeah. And I was that person. You know, I was a front-end dev for most of my dev career. And these days, you know, I'm a suit, so I don't get to write as much code. But the, you know, I did feel that, you know, especially towards the end of that phase of my career, where I was like, this feels more like engineering than like, declarative markup or the expressive parts of the web that was what drew me in the first place. And, and they don't have to be intentional. It's not necessarily oppositional, but that sense that there's something closer to an expressive feel, I think is just very, very powerful to people. And you see it, it's interesting because like if you talk to writers, even people that write books or screenplays or whatever, you know, they're all used, they use Google Docs as sort of the standard. Oh, we can go in there and we can edit together at the same time, and it's cool. And visual designers have that capability in Figma or InVision or whatever, you know, Sketch, whatever tools they're using, where they're sort of able to draw together, create together, design together. Obviously, in gaming, like nobody plays single player games anymore, right? It's all multiplayer collaborative games. And then coding is still this world left to be sort of single player. Even what we call social coding or collaboration is really, let me throw this code over the wall to you and hope you don't slap it back at me with my pull request being rejected.
Yeah.
And rather, I think about like the ability, I see this on Glitch every day. If you have an error, there's an editor in the browser and it's got a, you know, it'll lint and catch errors and that kind of stuff. And if you want, there's a little emoji of the person with their hand raised and you can click that if you get stuck. And the homepage will say, you know, Jonathan wants help. You know, Jennifer, do you want to go in and help him? And click on the thing, and you're in there coding together in real time, together in the code. And
oh, that's cool.
And then if somebody helps you, you say thank you, and you click the button. Their screen fills with hearts, and it's just this like moment. It's like this is what it should feel like when you make something, and that you're surrounded by people who want to help you and collaborate with you and help you create that thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to like in my mind, I'm trying to imagine what is an allegory to this. What is another place in life where we actually have that kind of collaborative, you know, I'm thinking like walking around the supermarket and trying to find a particular fruit that is esoteric and I can't find it. And somebody says, can I help you?
Yeah.
Like that seems like the closest representation in the physical world.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely that sense of we in the physical world and community, we help each other all the time. You know, I'm sure you've been at the supermarket, somebody can't reach the top shelf and you can.
Yeah.
And they're like, can you get that? You know, can you get that can of beans for me? And you'll get up there and get it. And I see this having a kid, like an 8-year-old. And if I'm at the playground, kids will ask each other, will you push me on the swing? And will you, you know, open up the gate for me? I can't reach the handle or whatever it is. And they do it reflexively. It's innate. It's a thing that people love to do is a little bit of help. That thing that's easy for me, but maybe hard for you, is the gift I can give you that costs me nothing. And that reaffirms our humanity to one another. And we have provided each other so few spaces to do that in the technical world, even though it is one of our deepest impulses.
So this leads to maybe a more kind of a deeper systemic question. Why did we get there? Why did we get to this place where you know, first of all, asking for help felt like an admission rather than a human moment. And secondly, I guess a more important question is, you know, how did we get to this place where the barrier to entry was so high to begin with? You know, what is that? What do you think the history is behind what causes or caused that?
You know, there are a lot of factors. One of the fundamental things about asking for help, and I talk about this with our product team all the time, is you're putting yourself in a position of vulnerability. And mm-hmm. so you have to create an environment where that asking for help is normal and rewarded. And actually, we do this thing when you raise your hand, you ask for help on Glitch, that you, these little kind of bubbles and this very colorful, you know, experience comes together. And we're sort of saying this is normal. And by making it a visible thing, it's one of the few things you can do in the editor. Like, we've limited it very much. It's a normal thing to do. It's as easy and accessible as liking a photo is on Instagram. It's very core. And so we normalized it. But it's about this sort of sense of, like, this is a place you can be vulnerable. And that even goes down into something like, I mean, the name of it is Glitch, right? So obviously mm-hmm. mistakes are okay here. Obviously, nothing is supposed to be perfect here. And we try to communicate that through design. We try to communicate that through language. But it's all very much about setting an expectation that there's a place where, you know, perfection is not expected. Humanity is expected. And the imperfections are welcomed. And I think that's one big important piece. You know, I think a second part about how did we get to the gatekeeping? You know, where the who has access to the information and who is deemed correct and who's allowed to have it. You know, honestly, some of this is economics, right? Mm-hmm. The information of how to make code, how to make software, is information that potentially allows you to become part of the class of workers who are amongst the most well-compensated workers in the history of the world.
Yeah.
Right? That is an elite priesthood. And once that started to become true, it is no surprise that some people will try to erect a barrier or some gatekeeping around it. And then obviously all the other, you know, the systems of injustice that we have in society replicate themselves in technology, no different than anywhere else. But I see this where, you know, we share at Glitch, co-founders and a lot of sort of historic DNA with Stack Overflow, our Silicon company. And there I saw this very positive impulse from day one about not having a proprietariness or a priesthood around the data. Like, we want to democratize access to the information mm-hmm. of what it takes to be a coder and a good coder. And yet, you know, somewhat notoriously, there'd been a lot of hostility and a lot of sort of rules lawyering about how do you ask the question and who's allowed to ask a question and how do you phrase it. And people felt scolded. They felt unwelcome, you know? And I think it's changing and evolving. I don't diminish at all that that's been historically true. Two, I don't, want to dismiss that huge efforts have been made by the community and by leadership to fix it too. So, like, both those things are true. But all of it comes together and you say, even with a good intent of democratizing information, there was a reward system set into place that inadvertently, I think, rewarded a certain type of gatekeeping that wasn't about who can access the information. Because you can be totally not logged in. We've all been there where you Google an error message, you end up with Stack Overflow, and you get an answer, and that's good.
Right. Yeah.
But the to truly participate and to truly feel welcome, you know, barriers were erected. And though I have a high degree of confidence those things will be fixed, you know, in the fullness of time, what I see is this impulse to replicate, you know, the institutions around us, the social institutions and the cultural barriers, and that we still see, you know, in so many companies, like the one I work at, it used to do whiteboard interviews until I joined. Mm-hmm. We're never going to do that again because I wouldn't pass it.
Right.
And I think I deserve to be here. And I think that, you know, our whole team deserves to be. And we started to evolve and we saw that, you know, a lot of things changed. All of a sudden, one, the product that we made became more welcoming to more kinds of coders when we became more welcoming to more styles of coders. Mm-hmm. And our team got, you know, much more diverse, much more representative. We still have a lot of work to do, but it's, you know, well, the bar is low in tech, so we've already cleared the bar of at least being a little more inclusive than most other tech companies, and we want to keep going. But, you know, without doing that for the team, then we certainly couldn't do it for the community. And those things are linked.
We're going to take a quick sponsor break and then come back and continue our discussion with Anil Dash. Today's episode is sponsored by Flatiron. At Flatiron School, you learn how the future is being built so you can change anything, starting with a new career in user experience and UI design. No matter where you are in your career, it might be time to go back to school. Students at Flatiron School are parents, musicians, travelers, and working professionals from all walks of life. If you're an entrepreneur running your own business, or a marketer that's diving deeper into user behavior, or maybe you're just someone who loves design, it's time to level up your creative chops, and you can do exactly that at Flatiron School. In just 24 weeks at one of the global WeWork campuses or online, you can learn to change not only your career, but the world around you. Flatiron School's committed instructors have both industry and teaching experience and are backed by the master teachers and learning experience designers to ensure that you get the best possible support. While you're in school, you even work on real client projects, so you'll graduate with a portfolio of real client work. On top of that, you will have one-on-one support from a dedicated career coach and a money-back guarantee. You can learn more at flatironschool.com/terms. That's where the complete details are. And when you're ready to make the decision, head over to flatironschool.com/developer T. That's flatironschool.com/developer T. Thank you again to Flatiron School for sponsoring today's episode of Developer T. Now let's get back into our discussion with Anil Dash. So I think there's people who are listening to this right now and they got caught on the question about whiteboarding. We haven't really talked about it a lot on the show.
Sure.
And I want to know kind of two sides of this question, right? The first side is, you know, what is wrong with that from the skill evaluation level, right? If we're evaluating how good of a engineer or what kind of value you're going to bring to the table, what's wrong with it in that frame? But also in the cultural, as you were saying, we're replicating our cultural biases, for example. What kind of sub-selections are accidentally being made through that kind of selection process, through whiteboarding interviews, for example?
Well, it's interesting. This is a very personal story for me because, so I, you know, the company I run, Glitch, used to be called Fog Creek, and the founder, the co-founders are Michael Pryor and Joel Spolsky. And Joel used to write a blog called Joel and Software. Mm-hmm. It was very influential, you know, in the early 2000s on software development. And he really was one of the people that popularized doing whiteboard interviews. And I went back and I read his sort of original blog posts on this thing. And what he said was, you know, during the interview process, you should capture how people think about the code they're going to write. How do they structure it? How do they approach the problem? And, you know, it's like a whiteboard could be a useful tool for while you're in discussion with the candidate to see how they think and have to be able to map it out and give you something to respond to. And that's very reasonable, I think very thoughtful and smart. Like, you don't want somebody stuck in the weeds of like, I can't get the compiler to run, so I can't, you know what I mean, or whatever it is that's there. So you just want to sort of capture how do they think about the problem. That impulse, I think, is very, very positive. What I think happens a lot in tech is there's a like sort of a cargo culting of like the ritual becomes more important than the purpose of it. And so I think what happened over time in many organizations, and to some degree our own until relatively recently, is it became kind of a hazing ritual. And it was, show me your knowledge of some arcane data type or data structure, or, you know, so what you've memorized, and recite it to me on this whiteboard in front of me, right? And it became very contrived. And very obviously, nobody's ever written code that runs on a whiteboard, right? Like, it's definitionally not the actual environment that you work in. And the thing I came back to was, I want our interview process and our recruiting process to resemble the work as closely as it can. And the way we work is not one person on their own being grilled and examined by somebody else. We work together. We code together in Glitch. I mean, that's how the company runs. And so our interview process kind of works the same way. We'll be like, here's some code. Let's work through it together. And we can talk about how you would solve it, what your approach is. And by all means, if you are Googling while writing that code, if you are going to Stack Overflow writing that code, great. I don't want you to be working from memory about some, you know, API that changes every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I want you to look at the docs. And so all of that put together, I think what happened is this very well-intended and actually very thoughtful process of let me see how you think became about the ritual of how that happens rather than the output. And the net result of that was it was used as a wedge or a lever to re-erect barriers around who gets included, because people wanted to self-select for who has that degree from that institution that I want, or who has that identity or profile of what everybody else in the rest of the team does. And you can use it as a bit of a gate or a fence around who gets in. That thing, I think, is that misuse of it, I think, is really poisonous. And to that point, it's worth discarding the entire ritual if it's so often misused.
It almost feels like the troll on the bridge that asks you, and I don't mean to mischaracterize all these well-meaning people, but for the sake of the cultural discussion, like a troll on a bridge that asks you to solve an esoteric riddle that has nothing to do with, whatever is beyond that bridge, right? It's this moment where you have to have a passcode basically to get through. And while it evaluates maybe a particular vertical of a skill, it also leaves out a bunch of other things and includes a bunch of irrelevant things, I feel like.
Yeah. And I thought really deeply about it. And I think it's understandable how we got here, because one, everybody's moving quickly. You got to hire quickly. You got to move quickly. You got to make a decision quickly. So what could be, it takes a long time to write good code, right? So what can I do that would be a shorthand, quick signifier of knowledge? Well, a trivia test, basically, right?
Yeah,
this obscure test.
Right.
And so that symbolizes a larger knowledge, and maybe, it's imperfect, but this will be useful. Sort of similarly, there's an enormous amount of anxiety around the bad hire. It's a really interesting thing. Why do we hire somebody bad? And the truth of it is, like, you already have, right?
If you
have more than three people at your company, like, there's different levels of skill, and how do you define bad? But also, you would know, right? Like, that's not so much the issue. It's this plausible deniability of, like, well, nobody can pass through our screening. We're very, very meticulous. And there's, I think, just an underlying anxiety that nobody wants to be on the hook or to blame for who let that person in here that didn't know how to do this one task. And the truth of it is, and this is something that, I think we really built as a fundamental principle into how Glitch works, but I think many of the sort of future forward-looking coding environments are doing this, is we're all constantly copying each other's code and looking at each other's documentation and referencing what somebody else's code has on GitHub and doing view source on somebody's web page. Like there's all these things we're doing that are about learning together, sharing together, and it makes the work better. Mm-hmm. And so anything that doesn't honor that tradition of coders love to collaborate. Coders are fundamentally generous people who like to share their ideas with the world and like others to build on what they made. And anything that betrays that tradition sort of drifts away from the most positive aspects of why we started doing this in the first place.
Yeah, I would say this is kind of fundamental to any cultural revolution, is the ability to pass on information. You know, that's what differentiates humans, for example, from other primates. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we can pass these things on, because that's the only way we can build on top of the knowledge. If we had to do everything from first principles and that's the way we lived, man, we would be, that would be pretty difficult, right?
Yeah, we wouldn't have civilization. And every great cultural artifact, every great expression is a remix. Like, everything is built on somebody else's work. Everything is a reference to somebody else's work. You know, that song you love, that musician was influenced by something else. That film you love, that filmmaker saw other films and shaped what they did. And it doesn't mean they're not innovative. It doesn't mean they're not brilliant. It doesn't mean you weren't moved and touched by what they said. It just means we exist in a context of building on each other's work. And anything, as soon as you look at it through that lens, you see how much of the creation of software and technology is made solitary. We are meant to be alone in the dark on our own, nobody else around us. And our creation of software is meant to happen on its own in a vacuum without being informed by other disciplines, by being informed by the arts, by being informed by civics, by being informed by sociology and anthropology. And that disconnect at the systemic and structural level is just as poisonous to the software we make as the disconnect at the personal level is to our psyche in working alone and not having help.
Yeah. And I think this is something that is because of the history of software development, kind of where it came from. Perhaps we kind of held on to the limited nature that it started out with. But I believe that some of the original kind of people in this, in tech, some of the early, whatever you want to call them, forefathers, many of them are still alive because this is so new. But they would absolutely say, no, please pull from the arts, pull from, you know, pull from whatever inspiration you can. We just did it that way because we were working basically with metal. Like we were, it was so
well, computing resources were so scarce.
Exactly.
And the knowledge was so scarce that, you know, they did what they could. But, you know, it's funny because people will look at sort of the titans of tech. If you, Steve Jobs, right? Archetypical tech titan. And they will copy wearing a black turtleneck. But if you listen to the man and what he talks about and what his public persona was, he spent as much time talking about the Beatles and the music he loved and their obsessiveness to the entire company about film and music and these things as anything else. You know, same with, I look at like Microsoft, and though he's often overshadowed by Bill Gates, you know, Paul Allen, the other co-founder, this is a guy, like the animating force of his life was his love for Jimi Hendrix. You know, and his his what he wanted to do to fund the creation of the, you know, the Music Experience Museum, the Rock and Roll Museum, and all the other stuff that he did was like this, like this guy, and he could play too. He could play. He was a pretty good guitarist, and cared deeply about that. And so this, there's this animating things, even in Gates's case, and he's probably one of the, you know, definitely one of those people who feels more into that nerd stereotype and very analytical. But you know, he was raised in a family that cared about philanthropy. His mother was on the board of the United Way with the guy who was in charge of the IBM PC project at IBM. And the reason he got the introduction for them to be able to sell MS-DOS to IBM for the IBM PC was a connection through his parents' philanthropy. And it was later that his father became the first chair of the Gates Foundation and moved to philanthropy. And like that is these deep connections to very human things, right? Yeah. You don't go into philanthropy at a global scale and try to end polio. And you don't build a museum to Jimi Hendrix, you know, unless you care about some human passions.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of my discussion with Anil Dash. I hope you will join us for part two if you don't want to miss out on that. The easiest way is to subscribe in whatever podcasting app you use. The episode will automatically end up on your device. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Thank you again to Flatiron School for sponsoring today's episode. Head over to flatironschool.com/developertea to get started today. Developer Tea is a part of the Spec Network. Head over to spec.fm to find all of the episodes of the show, as well as other shows that are relevant to designers and developers who are looking to level up in their careers. Today's episode was produced by Sarah Jackson. My name is Jonathan Cottrell, and until next time, enjoy your tea.